From the Sky News Centre at 6. The Metropolitan Police say they're investigating why the force didn't respond to an alarm call which went off during the central London jewellery raid over Easter. The call was logged as not requiring police attendance. The Prime Minister's defended the Conservatives' election campaign after Ed Miliband described personal attacks on him as desperate. Defence Secretary Michael Fallon said the Labour leader couldn't be trusted on security and would stab Britain in the back. But he says he doesn't regret the attack on Mr Miliband.
This is a general election that's taking place here. This is the rough and tumble of politics, and the public need to know who is going to lead their country and what he is likely to do to get into power in Downing Street. That's a perfectly legitimate question.
Catholic bishops in Scotland appear to have entered the nuclear weapons debate. A letter to be read at 500 Catholic churches this Sunday says the weapons continue to represent a grave threat to the human family. A 13-year-old boy has been jailed for at least 11 years after admitting murdering a builder. Christopher Barry was trying to enter a block of flats in North London last December when he was stabbed. More than a third of British Muslims blame police and MI5 for radicalising their young generation. A Sky News survey found more than 70% of British Muslims think Islam is compatible with British values, compared with 52% of non-Muslims. Entrepreneur Sadiq Basha doesn't believe divisions run deep between Muslims and other ethnic groups.
There is a bit of a mistrust among young generation, but that is a very, very minority. In a majority as a Muslim community as a whole, we work together, and majority of them believe in diversity and working together as a culture.
And Mamma Mia is closing on Broadway after 14 years. The ABBA musical, though, won't close in London, however. That's the latest. I'm Adam Lindsay.
BCFM 93.2 are your local radio station, which is why we're bringing you unrivaled coverage of the local and national 2015 elections.
I'm one of the first borns around here, and they've got everything.
The local issues.
I'm privileged to be Bristolian.
The national agenda.
I think community radio is a very, very valuable instrument.
Uncontaminated by the mainstream media, we ask the questions that you want the answers to, in a way that only BCFM can.
I'm glad BCFM is here to share it with us.
What would you like to know? Send your questions to election@bcfmradio.com. BCFM. We hear from our youth MP and explore the perspectives of our diverse communities.
Gypsy travellers and Eastern Europeans have made Bristol home too.
Hear the politics show on Fridays at 5pm with Tony Gosling, and listen to Breakfast at 7 in the morning and Getting Bristol Home at 4pm every weekday afternoon. We'll also be running an election special on the night of May the 7th into the early hours of the morning to bring you all the latest local information and results with reporters at all of the counts. Plus, on-the-spot interviews and an array of studio guests alongside our host, Matthew Tosh.
The only way to make a change is to actually say something.
So for impartial, hyper-local, up-to-the-minute coverage of the closest and most exciting election in years, there's only one station to choose. And why take our word for it? We're the Sony Gold Radio Academy best small station in the Southwest. BCFM 93.2, your official 2015 election station.
There are some people who talk and some people who don't, which means that there are some people who leave this place and some who do not leave. You are obviously staying.
Has it ever occurred to you that you're just as much a prisoner as I am?
Oh, my dear chap, of course, I know too much. We're both lifers. I am definitely an optimist. That's why it doesn't matter who number one is. It doesn't matter which side runs the village.
It's run by one side or the other.
Oh, certainly. But both sides are becoming identical. What, in fact, has been created? An international community. A perfect blueprint for world order. When the sides facing each other suddenly realize that they're looking into a mirror, they will see that this is the pattern for the future.
The whole earth as the village, yes.
That is my hope. What's yours?
I'd like to be the first man on the moon.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. spot the irony on the anniversary of Magna Carta, the British government is abolishing fair trials. Homeless Britain, Bristolians and their supporters are coming together tomorrow for a march and rally through the city centre, calling for an end to evictions and more council spending on emergency accommodation. I'm joined by Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action, Squatters Support Group. And Sunday's Malcolm X Film Festival is happening this weekend. These are the films and the talks a million miles away from the mind-numbing garbage on offer from the mainstream cinemas, and talks too by anti-racism activists and filmmakers. I'm joined by one of the organisers, Sukant Chandan. But secret courts. It's ironic, isn't it, in the year of Magna Carta, the anniversary, that child by jury is being dispensed with. And remember, the Guildford 4 and the Birmingham 6, would those miscarriages of justice be exposed? Today, secret courts have begun to try the most controversial cases in the country, and some believe the authorities are actually fitting up terror suspects. Well, to discuss this and other things, I'm joined on the phone now by a Monsignor. I'm not sure if he still is a Monsignor, but Bruce Kent used to be the chair of CND, and he's now campaigning to end these secret courts. Hi, Bruce, and welcome to the Politics Show. Hello, Bruce. Can you hear me? Hello, Bruce. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Can you tell us what's going on with the court system now? That you think is concerning.
Well, the court system at the moment, with regard to people who are under suspicion of terrorism, is really that you could be kept in prison or under house arrest indefinitely. You can't get out of the secret court, the SIAC, Special Immigration Appeals Commission. You can't get out of that, and you don't know what you've been accused of. All that the High Court can do is can talk about the procedure wasn't proper or something, so it goes backwards and forward between them. You can't get to the Supreme Court, and until the Supreme Court has turned you down, you can't get to the European Court of Human Rights. And so I'm dealing with a chap who's been effectively in and out of prison since 2003, and without any hope of really ending the procedure and getting back home to Algeria.
So what's he been accused of?
How do I know? That's the whole point. The accusation and all the evidence with it is secret. You wouldn't believe it. I mean, I went to a public meeting and I said this the other day, and the chap at the back said, "Don't be ridiculous. This is England. It couldn't possibly happen." Well, it does happen. These people, the Special Immigration Advisory Commission, hears secret evidence and secret witnesses, and this is nobody knows what they said or who put them up to it. And it may well be, in this particular case, that it's actually the Algerian government who's done it. That's what happened in the Libyan case, which that came out. The British government had to pay a great deal of money in compensation. But nobody knows who's producing the evidence, and so you can't rebut it.
So you're saying that evidence is being produced by foreign governments, which is convicting and imprisoning people here, and nobody knows if that evidence is in any way true?
No, it's not put to anybody. And I don't know it's foreign governments. I don't know anything about it. All I know is that the tribunal is secret. Everybody in the tribunal, all the witnesses and ordinary people are asked to leave the court, and then something happens, and then you get a ruling. But you have no idea what you're accused of or who accused you. I know it sounds utterly mad, but it's actually going on in England this time.
I know also inquests, particularly police inquests, as well as some of these inquests of terrorist suspects, they don't even give people's names. They're just given numbers or letters.
Oh, yes, I'm not giving you his name because I don't want to jeopardise his position. But he's now known as Y. My man is just Y. So he's completely dehumanised in a way. He doesn't have a family name or any connections like that. He's just Y. Now, if I gave you the name, which I think probably you may know, but if I gave you the name, I would put him in some jeopardy of being whipped off back to prison. In 2005, I think, he was out of prison for about 3 or 4 months after an acquittal, He went down to report one day, and the policeman in the police station said, "Well, just step inside here, shut the door, you're going back to Long Lartin." No, leaving all his things behind.
That was just one episode, but can you just take us through, I mean, we'll have to call him Y for the time being, take us through what you know of his ordeal over the last decade or so.
Of Y in particular?
Yeah.
He's the one I focused on. Well, Y came here in the year 2000. He was a member of the Algerian party, which was overthrown by the military in, I think, 96 or 97. And he was a member of the opposition party. He was then put in prison and tortured, and the marks of torture are on his body. Half his upper teeth are missing as a result of the treatment. He was then let out in Algeria and fled the country and went to Spain and France and eventually came here and ended up in the notorious mosque in Finsbury Park as selling books. He had nothing to do with the mosque. He was selling books in the bookshop. And I think that's what did him in, really, because then there was a secret report that he was a terrorist and he was into prison for 2.5 years before the trial. Came out in 2005 and was promptly put back in prison again 2 months later. But it's just gone. I know, when I tell this story, it just seems so mad. No one will believe it. But he's been in and out. And worst of all, that when they put him into a accommodation, as they did in the Midlands somewhere, miles away from anywhere, and they said, "Oh, but he can always go swimming." Well, I think that's very nice. He's got a big tag, a big, about 9-inch long thing tied to his leg, and he's meant to go swimming as a recreation. What will the other swimmers think? And then he gets a notice saying, "In 2 weeks' time, you're moving somewhere else." So he's got to keep hopping around the country. Every time he gets to know a doctor or a library or the local mosque or whatever, he's shoveled off again. It is absolutely bizarre.
Well, there's an article in The Guardian entitled "The Government's Persecution of the Muslim Community is Alienating the Very People Whose Support is Needed to Stop Further Atrocities," which, it's certainly, if it's not Y, it mentions somebody, or I better not name, who it says, comma, known publicly as Y. But I mean, this just sounds incredible. How many people do you think have been caught up in this kind of legal minefield? Which, of course, there's two aspects to this, Bruce. One is that it certainly is making a lot of money for lawyers. And secondly, you've got a situation here where it's possible that the sort of anti-terrorist type police are using people like Y to hit their targets.
Yes, everything is possible. I mean, the numbers, I would have thought somewhere between 20 and 30 would be at present under the SIAC administration. I don't know, but I think that's about what it would be. And the country they're focusing on is largely Algeria. I mean, they focused on Libya before until we killed Gaddafi, and then these people were brought out of prison, and some of them had to be compensated. But it's not an enormous number, but to me it's an absolute violation of any kind of law that we're meant to have in this country.
What have you been able to do about it, Bruce?
Well, I keep sending, the reason you're on this phone now with me is that I've sent you, I think, a broadsheet about it, hoping that someone will take an interest and do something about it. And by giving me this outlet today, you've certainly woken up a number of other people to the situation. I think they should all write to their members of parliament, wait till the election's over, write to the member of parliament saying, "Is it true that people can be detained indefinitely in this country?" And the MP won't know, but they can put them on to me and I'll provide all the facts.
Now, the other aspect of this, of course, is in many of these terrorism trials, you've got people from the security services giving evidence anonymously in disguise from behind a screen. I mean, it does seem that we're moving further and further away from justice being seen to be done.
We're miles away from exactly what the Magna Carta said. Everybody's entitled to a fair trial in front of his peers. That was what, an open trial. That's what, 8 centuries ago or something. We've moved a long way away from that. And I can understand the man who said to me, "This can't be true in England," because most people think it couldn't be true in England. But it is true in England. It's happening.
What about other aspects like the lack of juries? Because this also seems to be, I mean, I did quite a lot of reporting on the inquest, for example, into the 7/7 London bombings. Noticed that the coroner decided that it wasn't necessary to have a jury. It was going to be too complicated for a jury. Also, in high-level trials like ones to do with the City of London bankers' trials, the judges are saying it's too complicated for a jury to understand. I mean, surely that can't be legal.
Well, I'm afraid it is happened. I don't know the rules of when they can waive a jury, but there are times when they can waive a jury. And when I was on trial, being personal, for cutting wire at American base, the judge let me talk about international law for about 10 minutes, but he sent the jury out. So the jury heard none of it. And when the jury came back, the judge just said, did this man cut a strand of wire or didn't he? That's your question. And the jury had no choice but to say, yes, but the reason why I did it wasn't available to them. So the jury system is not perfect, but it's better than not having a jury system.
Now, can I take you back to the 1980s for a minute, Bruce? Because I can remember as a young lad watching a programme about your CND and it being really quite destabilised by the Thatcher government and even infiltrated. I think it was a programme called This Week with someone called Kathy Massetta. Can you just tell us what happened to the group then? Because this is, again, a gross injustice when the state actually tries to destabilise what is a totally legitimate, what you were effectively at the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and an NGO, a non-governmental organisation, doing a perfectly legitimate democratic bit of lobbying.
Well, Kathy Massetta was an honourable and decent person, and she was working in at Cheltenham in the special security place, and she realised what was going on, and she got so indignant about it, she blew the gaff, and she was very lucky not to be prosecuted. I think there was some reason why they couldn't, but anyway, they wanted to shut her up, but they couldn't. And she revealed that we had had a spy planted in the office, and I think his name was Harry Newton, a nice old chap. He used to come in and stuff envelopes, and he'd always try to engage me in conversation. And he, in the secret report he wrote to his bosses, he said, Bruce Kent is a pseudo-Marxist. I don't know what a pseudo-Marxist is. I'm not a Marxist anyway, but he was feeding this kind of nonsense into the security services. So that was when the lid came really off and we saw exactly what they were trying to do. But we never had any secrets. We were quite open. We said what we were doing. Come and sit in on the meetings if you want to know what we're planning.
I mean, were you quite surprised to find out that somebody that had been a sort of acquaintance of yours, quite a friendly chap, was actually a bit there to spy on you?
Well, you don't know. You don't know. The Campaign Against the Arms Trade had in it a spy who was, to all intents and purposes, the most courageous, vigorous campaigner against arms sales and all this. And we all looked up to him, and a great man and great courage. And then it came out that he was actually a plant about 2 years later. I don't think CND has ever been caught quite as badly as that, but poor old Campaign Against the Arms Trade certainly was.
In the last hour, we were discussing what looks like a possible end to the Trident. At least that is the non-renewal of it from the SNP's point of view. I guess this is something that you've been wanting to see for many, many years, Bruce.
Well, I think the SNP does offer a little candle of hope, really. Because they're breaking the mould, and if they are in a balanced position with Plaid and with the Greens, they could have a great influence on a future government. If Labour has to deal with another a minority party, that party will demand a price, and quite right too. And I think we're moving into interesting times, really, because the whole business of renewing Trident is absolutely back to Rudyard Kipling. That we've got to be bigger and stronger than anybody else in the world. It's absolute nonsense, but that's what we're pretending to do. And, of course, nuclear weapons have no value against the people who actually do threaten us now. I mean, ISIS, who are clearly a clever and manipulating and dangerous lot, they're not worried about dying. They're going to paradise. So you can't threaten them with nuclear weapons.
What would you say to people like Rory Stewart MP and others who are saying, well, actually, the Russia now is becoming more of a threat, and actually that the nuclear weapons have kept the peace for decades because although you've never used it, it's a threat that you may use it that actually keeps the peace, this whole idea of mutually assured destruction?
That's what they always say. But we've had, I don't know how many wars between states, probably 35 or 40 since the atom bombs were dropped, and lots of other civil wars as well. And both the major powers, America, United States, was totally humiliated in Vietnam, fleeing from the top of an embassy building by helicopter, and their nuclear weapons were of no significance whatever. And the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and were kicked out 2 years later. Nuclear weapons are completely irrelevant. I mean, the Argentinians had the cheek, Argentinians, to take the Falkland Islands, and there are we bristling with nuclear weapons. It's an illusion of security, and that's what people have to know, have to realise.
Now, you've lived through the end of the Soviet Union, and you've seen all that. It must have been quite...
I'm not hearing that one very well.
You've lived through the end of the Soviet Union, Bruce, and we were supposed to have, in the early 1990s, something called the Peace Dividend. Oh. But it seems like now that's slipping out of our grasp.
It's gone. The world is now spending, believe it or not, nearly $1.75 trillion US dollars a year on war and weapons. It's an enormous sum of money. It's more than anything else we spend on. And yet we don't talk about it. And that's one of the problems of many of our big charitable organizations raising money for good causes abroad. But they very rarely make the link with the military expenditure that is really draining countries. That's not true of war on want. War on want are head and shoulders above the others on that issue.
Well, it must be rather frustrating for you as a campaigner for many years to see that actually defence spending going up again and the public services being stripped away.
It's completely bonkers. Yes, it's very annoying. But what is encouraging is that, you know, I think in November or December, about 175 countries met in Vienna under the invitation of the Austrian government to say basically that all this is nonsense. We've got to stop this and start behaving sensibly as one world. And so I think that the message that I've been pushing and others have been pushing, it may not be echoed in Whitehall, but it's certainly going on around the world.
Bruce Kent, former head of the campaign for nuclear disarmament. I just wonder if people are interested in following the case of the Algerian, we're only allowed to call him Y, which has been going on now for 15 years, a kind of merry-go-round of in and out of prison, and actually not even being told what he's being accused of. Appalling situation. How can they support him and find out more about this case and do something?
Well, I think the best thing is give them my email. I don't mind. You've got it, I think. I don't mind the people getting.
Can you tell us an email address now?
It's Bruce K at UK2 the numeral .net.
Okay, UK2.net. And I suppose if you look around for Prisoner Y, I'll tell you what the other thing I'll do, Bruce, is I'll put that article from The Guardian from 10 years ago or so up on the internet, where it actually does name somebody called Y from Algeria. I better not name them now, but I will put a link to that up on our show page.
Yes, you could do that.
At www.thisweek.org.uk. Bruce Kent, thank you ever so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much for the space.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Bruce Kent there, Martin, talking about an appalling case of an Algerian. But, I mean, what is the context here? In the 1990s, there was lots going on in Algeria. I think, if I'm right in saying, they elected actually a moderately Islamic government, which was democratically elected, but then it was crushed ruthlessly.
Yeah, it was the FIS, the Islamic Salvation Front of Algeria, who were a bit like the Muslim Brotherhood or the Justice and Development Party in Turkey. They clearly were going to win the election, and the army stepped in and began a civil war against the population. And one of the tricks that the army used to use in Algeria, which has become very common since then, is they set up a group called the GIA, the Armed Islamic Group, who then carried out all sorts of atrocities, which were then blamed on the FIS. In other words, following the gangs and counter-gangs manual originally put together by Kitson and the British in Kenya.
So you're saying that the Rami was carrying out ruthless attacks and then just the local
the
media...
The 1993 bombing of the Paris Metro was blamed on the FIS. It was carried out by the GIA, but in actual fact carried out by the Algerian army as a means of discrediting, because of course the French state was supporting the army, as the British and the Americans are now supporting the Egyptian army to oppress the democratically elected
government.
This
is fascinating. It's mad, because say the Muslim Brotherhood, who should be the democratically elected government of Egypt right now, I mean, they would be an enormous great theological and ideological counter to ISIS, wouldn't they? They're very different attitudes, and yet they are banned, and many of them are in prison and under death sentences.
Yes, well, ISIS are very similar to the GIA. They've been created by Western and Saudi intelligence services to undermine democratic Islamic politics. Islam has a perfectly legitimate place in political life, and there's plenty of Islamist parties around the world. But the way to undermine them, and the way that they are being undermined, is by the creation of more extreme groups who discredit the whole concept of Islam. And this has actually been very much part of British imperial strategy going back to the 19th century.
Now, there's a government report on the Muslim Brotherhood, which has concluded that they should not, it's a British government, that should not be classified as a terrorist organisation. This is on the 15th of March, this came out. This is 48 hours before the delivery of the budget, apparently, this came out. David Cameron is braced, so says Nigel Morris in the Independent, is braced for a diplomatic row with Saudi Arabia and Egypt when the government today publishes a long-awaited review into the Muslim Brotherhood, which is set to clear it from being a terrorist organisation. He ordered the urgent investigation into the Islamist movement almost a year ago, but the release of its conclusions has been repeatedly delayed amid wrangling between ministers and officials over its findings. The Prime Minister has been accused of setting up the review under pressure from the Saudi ruling family, which was strongly opposed to the organisation under the late King, although his predecessor Salman appears in favour of softening this stance. The only thing is, Martin, that just as it was being released, the government, the cabinet, decided to suppress this report, which is exonerating the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, that's because they're probably under pressure from the US to line up behind, and the Egyptian government to line up against them. I mean, the whole thing is becoming very, very ridiculous. But let's try and put some real context in this. The creation of extremist Takfiri terrorist groups has been a joint project between the Saudi government and our own government and the Americans. And the purpose of these groups is A, to undermine moderate Muslim forces, and B, to create an enemy so that we can then have an excuse for intervening in the countries that we want to intervene in, e.g. Syria. Now, in actual fact, there are documented links between British intelligence services and military and the extremist groups operating in Syria. And if we wanted to stop those extremist groups, then we should start arresting non-Muslim intelligence officers. But we're not doing that, and that shows how unserious we are about tackling terrorism.
Okay,
it's a very serious situation.
Staying with the Middle East, a lawyer says Israel is to detain a Palestinian MP for 6 months. Prominent left-wing legislator Khalida Jawar was put under detention without trial, says the lawyer. This is last weekend on Al Jazeera English. Jawar was arrested during a raid on her house by the Israeli army last week. The Israeli army's placed a female Palestinian legislator under detention for 6 months without trial. She's a senior political leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a left-wing Palestinian faction being held for alleged activities in a hostile organisation, lawyer Mahmoud Hassan said on Monday this week. The PFLP is designated a terrorist organisation by Israel and the US. She is 52 years old and she's being held under Israeli administrative detention, which allows Israel to hold detainees for up to 6 months at a time without charges, the lawyer told the Associated Press.
Well, it's just more of this political repression of politically people that the powers that be don't want to have a voice. But really, much more sinister is the way in which the Israeli intelligence services have been supporting the al-Nusra Front, for example, inside Syria, who are al-Qaeda, effectively, and the Israelis are effectively supporting them.
Back to Palestine, Randa Wahbi, an advocacy officer at Adamir, which supports Palestinian prisoners, told Al Jazeera that the detained legislator's arrest was linked to her membership of the Palestinian Legislative Council's Committee on Prisoners. There's definitely a relationship between her work and the occupation forces' decision to arrest her. Last year, she was given a deportation order to Jericho, which she protested and was revoked by a military court. This, they believe, is retribution for fighting this deportation order.
Well, it's the usual kind of repression. Lots and lots of elected Palestinian politicians are in prison. As many elected politicians in Egypt are in prison. All over the world, there is repression and violence being meted out to ordinary people. And a lot of the terrorist groups which are supposedly fighting this repression are themselves manipulated fronts for the powers that be. And I think people have really got to get their heads around this. If we're going to get to the bottom of this kind of stuff, we're going to have to start investigating properly with independent police into all of these basically abuses of human rights.
Well, apparently the Israelis have thousands of political prisoners.
Indeed they do, and the Saudis have 30,000, I understand, in a very relatively small population. But they are our allies. They are our allies, and of course we were in favour of an armed uprising in Libya and an armed uprising in Syria, and the result in Libya was the assassination of the head of state, and in Syria has been the killing of up to 60,000 Syrian soldiers and thousands and thousands and thousands of civilians. We said that was a good idea because we believe in revolution. Revolution in the Arab world. If people won't have democracy, then people are going to stand up against them. The Libyan rebels said, no, we've got to get rid of Gaddafi. No matter what the price, we've got to fight. And Gaddafi went. And now, of course, we're saying that the Saudis, who have no elections at all, can intervene in Yemen, where they do have kind of elections, although they're rigged in favour of the Americans. Ultimately, of course, if we are in favour of revolutionary uprisings like that in Libya, which led to the assassination of the head of state with a bayonet up his backside over the front of a jeep, which was cheered on by Hillary Clinton, then I say revolution, bring it on. And that means Saudi Arabia and their allies are all legitimate targets. Now, is somebody going to lock me up for that? Because all I'm saying is this is British government policy, isn't it? We're in favour of revolutions. If there's no democracy and people haven't got a vote, then they're allowed to fight back, aren't they? They fought back in Libya. They're fighting back in Syria. Maybe we need revolution everywhere, including the smashing of the so-called democracies which are in alliance with the repressive regimes like Saudi Arabia. Let's get the war going and let's make sure the good guys win.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Sunday's Malcolm X Film Festival is taking place this weekend. These are films and the talks a million miles away from some of the mind-numbing garbage on offer in some of these mainstream cinemas. And talks, too, and dances, apparently, as well, by anti-racism activists and filmmakers. I'm joined on the line by one of the organisers of the day, Sukant Chandan. Hi, Sukant. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Can you tell us a bit about what you're planning for Sunday?
Yes, Sunday is the 7th of 8 events in 7 cities, including England and Ireland and West Belfast, of the first annual Malcolm X Film Festival. And in Bristol, we're starting, doors are opening at 1 o'clock, we're going to start around 2. And we have a whole afternoon of discussion and exploration of the life and struggle and sacrifice of Malcolm X. And basically, that was a struggle against colonialism and neo-colonialism and all the oppressions around that, probably at the pinnacle of which is patriarchy and white supremacy. But it impacts all kind of relations between humans and between humans and nature and the environment itself. We have a special guest speaker in person coming, which is Zimbabwean war veteran, liberation war veteran, I should say, and ZANU-PF member, and a decolonial scholar, and intellect in his own right, Mr. George Shire, and also via internet live video link, we have several global speakers, including Taimur Rahman from the People's Workers and Peasants Party, who are fighting for the rights of workers and peasants and opposing neo-colonial sectarian death squads in Pakistan. We also have an activist in the anti-war movement and anti-police brutality movement from New York, and a few others. So it should be a really interesting and inspiring and motivating and insightful afternoon of conversation. And also we have some fantastic South Indian food cooked by one of the best Asian cooks that I know.
Bristol's connection to a lot of the oppression is pretty strong, isn't it? I mean, we had the financing of the colonial discovery, reconnaissance and colonisation of the Native Americans, which 75 million, I believe, one of the estimates I read anyway, people died during that that genocide back hundreds of years ago. So I suppose this is actually something which is quite close to Bristol's heart.
Absolutely, and I'm hoping that the residents of Bristol who are aware and informed of this history will bring that knowledge and that analysis to the discussions that we're having. And very much so, I mean, when we talk about capitalism, I'm always, personally, I'm always trying to focus people on what they mean by capitalism. And capitalism, as I understand it, is the same thing as quote-unquote modernity or democracy or this concept called Europe or the West, in quotes. It really points to the same system. It's a genesis of a Western capitalist system, which Marx very very profoundly in his kind of quite flowery language said that the rosy dawn of the capitalist era was defined by two things, which was the entombment of Africans and the African continent and turning African into the warren of the hunting of black skins, is a direct quote from Marx, and the entombment of the native people in the Americas, which Britain was an absolute pioneer in all of this. So definitely the role that Bristol has played in this emerging global system of oppression is very important, and I think it's important that we do reflect on that in going forward in understanding the nature of the oppressive system that we face.
I mean, I was down at Bristol Cathedral for the Merchant Venturers Charter Day service just before Christmas, and noticed that the Bishop Mike from the Cathedral was really saying that Edward Colston's business dealings, he had a load of children that had been bussed in there, school children from across the city from the various schools at the Merchant Venturers, the Merchants Academy, Colston School, Colston Girls School, and telling them that Edward Colston's business dealings, the criticism of them was simply speculation.
Well, I heard a few comments you made about Libya and Yemen and Syria and Saudi Arabia just before I came on, but you know, things don't change much, do they? You know, when the Arab Spring, nay Arab Sting, is visited upon the people of the Middle East and North Africa, it's championed in the Western mainstream media as a wonderful, perfumed uprising of the peoples. But when the British were training the death squads in the British barracks in Cambridgeshire, and these Libyan death squad members, ostensibly part of this budding non-existent Libyan army that the British are training, started sexual assaults and all kinds of other affray and antisocial, quite traumatic behavior in Cambridgeshire, then you know, the nature of the Arab Sting, when it visits Cambridgeshire, is somehow, you know, deplorable, and they were sent back pretty sharpish. So yeah, this very kind of conceited colonial attitude is still very much in place today, and that's part of the reason I think it's important to go back to Malcolm X to inform our current strategies and where we're at globally and locally as well.
Now, a lot of us have heard of Malcolm X. Who was he, and why is he so significant? I mean, we've got this community centre in St Paul's named after him, but who was Malcolm X?
Well, we've only got probably a minute. We've got a minute to answer quite an important and very important question. But in a nutshell, the reason why Malcolm X was so important was that it was, you know, as it often the case, it's political times and it's political struggles that make the human stand out above all the rest. And Malcolm became a absolutely uncompromising opponent, trenchant opponent against the colonial and neocolonial system within the West. So the so-called Third World was rising up increasingly in wars of national liberation. And Malcolm was a part of that. He was a bridge to that struggle within the West itself. And, you know, he was very clear that racism cannot be defeated in the West until we are supporting the struggle of the African and Asian people across the planet who are fighting the same system. And I think he said that in such an articulate way, in such a fearless way, that he politically defined a new generation of revolutionary youth, not only black youth, but particularly black youth, but Latino and Asian and white radical youth, not only in the United States, but across the continents of the whole world. And that's why I think he remains such a foremost figure in a radical opposition that's married to the actually existing resistance of the people of the Global South, who are the greatest victims of what Dr. King called the greatest purveyors of violence on the planet today, which are the regimes in Washington and London and Paris.
Now, you talk about revolution, but often these revolutions get hijacked, don't they?
Quite, and I think, and you know, we don't know what Malcolm would have said if he was alive today, but judging Malcolm and his allies and his evolving analysis at the time, he was very much in the trench of struggle with people like Kwame Nkrumah, the Non-Aligned Movement, Nehru, Tito, Gamal Abdel Nasser, etc. And I don't think any of these people would have had any truck or any time whatsoever for these fake revolutions. I mean, Malcolm said it very clear that the media will have you supporting the people doing the oppressing and oppose the people who are being oppressed. If you swallow everything the media say to them. So I don't think Malcolm would have fallen for any type of fake revolutions funded by George Soros and company.
Anyway, I think if people are thinking about whether to go down to the Malcolm X Centre to watch a film on Sunday or go to one of the big mainstream cinemas, there's not really much of a choice to make there. Anyway, Sukant Chandan, can you just remind us where and when this is all taking place on Sunday?
Sure, it's this Sunday from roughly 2 to 8 p.m. at the Malcolm X Centre in St. Paul's in Bristol.
Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, not Sunday, but Saturday, homeless Bristolians and their supporters are coming together tomorrow for a march and rally through the city centre. And I'm joined by Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action. Hi, Ben. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hello. Thanks very much for bringing me on the show and being able to advertise this very important event.
Okay, so tell us, first of all, why?
Well, I think almost every adult or probably child in Bristol is aware that there's a housing crisis. It affects so many different people. We're aware that at least 1% of the population is at risk or is homeless. So we're going to, first of all, bring this to the attention of anybody in the public who doesn't know, and also bring it to the attention of the authorities, both local and national, that this is a situation we can no longer tolerate.
Ultimately, though, there simply isn't enough housing to go around, is there? There's a lot of immigration and that sort of thing is putting bigger demands, and not enough homes are being built. There's bound to be some homelessness.
The real issue is the long-run government policy of selling off council houses. I think 18,000 plus have been sold off, leaving 14,000 people on the waiting list. So successive national government policies have led to this crisis. Apparently, we've had information that it's no longer regarded as a top part of Bristol City Council's agenda, housing, and that the officers in this council are extremely concerned about this. So we can't blame the victims of government policy. We need to look at successive neoliberal governments and their attitude that maybe the private sector can look after housing. Clearly it's failed.
Now, before the changes brought in by Ken Clark, the Justice Secretary, to squatting, there was quite a lot going on. How's things changed for squatters? Because at the end of the day, if you find yourself homeless, well, for whatever reason, there's all sorts of reasons where you can end up on the street. In fact, we know, don't we, that there's been more evictions in 2014 than any year since records began, so a lot of people are ending up on the street. What's the law? Because there's quite a lot of empty buildings out there. I mean, if it was me, I'd be thinking immediately, I'm not going to sleep out on the street.
It's quite simple. If a building is classified as a residential property, that means anything that you could possibly live in and consider as a home, it's now been made illegal to live there. Anything non-residential, which is an extremely wide category, is still open to people to occupy.
But there's a sort of basic injustice about this, isn't there, that you've got the situation where back in the old days, if we can call it that, it was down to someone who'd left a property empty for however long, weeks, months, years, to institute proceedings, legal proceedings in the civil courts against squatters, get them removed that way. Now all they need to do is pick up the phone to the police.
Exactly. Basically, the tables have been turned even further against the those at the bottom end of the scale. And I presume that the Conservatives, being a party of the landlords, just want to make it even easier for landlords to keep onto their empty buildings and keep them as assets on the bank balance sheets.
But it is actually still quite legal to squat, so long as it's not a residential building. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
And is it? Does it work? Is it effective?
Well, it is effective. The police have finally accepted, I think they accepted about a year or two ago, that this was legal. People still continue to do it. The trouble is, of course, that they've been downgraded in their living conditions along with the rest of the population. So now we find that people are no longer living in decent empty homes. They're living in places that most people would consider unsuitable for living. But it's better than nothing.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Let's look at this from a slightly bigger point of view, because nobody can deny that there's a lot of pressure on housing. We just talked in the first hour, didn't we, about release of pension funds, for example, for people's pensions, so they can actually, that's one of the side effects of that is going to be it pumps up the buy-to-let market. It gives people more money to buy houses to buy-to-let, and that actually is going to increase the price it's costing to live. Is this what we mean by a housing crisis, and how should we deal with it?
Well, I mean, I think the way to deal with it is very obvious, is to provide council housing or social housing.
But there's no prospect
of
that.
We used to do it.
There is no prospect of that, is there?
Well, I think that's not quite true. We've still
not
got...
Not from the Labour Party, either.
No, I think in theory they're talking about having 200,000 affordable homes. But the weasel word is affordable. What's affordable to one person is not affordable to somebody else. And I think that we've ultimately got to take responsibility. Poorer people have never been able to afford decent accommodation. They couldn't afford it before council housing, and they can't afford it now. They used to live in slums. Do many people remember that? That's how most people used to live. And that's where we're going again, unless we get our finger out and take responsibility for providing decent low-cost homes for low-income people. If we're going to have a capitalist society with a big differential in wages and income between the people at the top and the bottom, the people at the bottom have to have their housing subsidised. Otherwise, we could go to places like Cuba, where everybody lives in the same, fairly basic level of accommodation.
I mean, isn't it a sign of a civilised society that the threat of eviction is minimised? I mean, this is something that the British have been rather good at in places like Ireland and Scotland. There have been fantastic amounts of evictions over the centuries.
Well, it's a constant attack on the people at the bottom. And, of course, the other thing, of course, we now know that far less people are registered to vote this time than the last election because of the changes in the regulations. And if you keep people moving around and moving from pillar to post, they never register to vote, and therefore their interests are never taken account of. And
so how has that... What's changed since the last election?
Well, there's now individual registration. So previously it was the householder, or one person in a house could register everybody in the house, whereas now it's individual registration, which was deliberately designed, in my view, to discourage registration from low-income people. They want them out of the system, and because their interests never get represented. But ultimately, as you say, it's a sign of a civilised society that everybody should have a basic standard of accommodation.
Ben, you're in touch with a lot of homeless people. Are they registered to vote? Do they care about voting? Would they like to vote? Can they vote?
Well, obviously, some are, some aren't. It's very difficult to know. I think no matter what your political views are, you want somewhere to live. It's very difficult to persuade people who are already up against it that they go the extra mile and actually bother to register, pay attention to political process. I mean, these are people who are living from day to day sometimes and are just really desperate. So, as has already been said, the whole thing seems to be a bit like, in America, disenfranchise the poor, just get voting back to those who are property owners. And we're back to the days of, it's like Cromwell, isn't it? If you don't own any property, you don't have a voice. I mean, is this really what we want in this country?
So what are you actually proposing? What would you like to see the City Council do? Anything specific?
A number of things need to be prioritised. First of all, attitude. The attitude must be that housing is a top priority for any national or local government.
I mean, surely the law is that the local authority does have an obligation to house people. But, you know, if you go in to present yourself as homeless at somewhere like Phoenix Court here in the city, where people are steered towards, the chances are they're not going to find you somewhere to sleep that night.
they're not going to find you anywhere at all if you're able-bodied. They're regularly telling people to go, and if you sleep on the pavement, I've seen 18-year-old young women being told this. I've seen 45-year-old guys who've just lost their job be told this. What kind of attitude is the council doing to its own people who probably pay council tax? What's going on here where the local government has just given up all responsibility to its own citizens? And what we want is a council, first of all, to prioritise this as an issue, then build more council housing, not at the stupid rate of 1,000 over, isn't it, 15 years that George Ferguson's just advertised as a massive victory. I mean, that's going to take about 200 years to sort out the problem. We want it built at the tens of thousands that were happening in the 60s. The other thing is, do things that you can do without costing money. Stop evictions of all kinds unless people are antisocial. Don't carry out the bedroom tax evictions. Don't evict people in council properties under the new rules. Don't remove squatters and travellers from sites. Just treat people like human beings. Talk to them, find out what they need, and leave them. If you can do nothing for them, stop harassing them.
Well, one of the frustrating things for me as I go around the city, walking, driving, wherever, is I see lots and lots of empty buildings. Are you actually able to use those as squatters? Could the council be using those and actually maybe making at least some, maybe turn them into hostels, that sort of thing? Because I know one of the first things that happened after the mayor came in a couple of years ago was that quite a lot of hostel beds were closed.
Well, it's a good point. I mean, we can, to some extent, with our limited resources, do up derelict non-residential buildings. But we're talking about an income of about 2,000 to 3,000 a year. Now, surely the council has a bit more than that. In Manchester, they're taking this seriously, and they're looking at turning empty brownfield sites, empty office buildings, into residential accommodation. One person recently suggested to me that students can be given what more or less pods, prefabricated housing within very big internal spaces, so that people can be given all the
services.
Are
you talking about like a kind of tent inside a warehouse?
No, these would be proper prefabricated housing inside very large empty spaces with all the services put in. This can be done very quickly. I mean, within 1 or 2 days.
Okay, so tell us what's happening tomorrow. When's it starting? And have you got talks or anything like that? A rally at the end?
It'll be 2 o'clock tomorrow at the bottom of Stokescroft, the Bear Pit. We'll be going through town. It'll turn up at the council house roughly about 4 o'clock. There will be rallies and talks. We won't be giving long speeches because that normally turns people off. But there'll be an opportunity for people who've got a point to make their voices heard. And then we hope that the council will listen to us, maybe invite us in to talk to them and actually show that they're interested in the very people that they're meant to do something for.
Now, we did see something like this a while ago, didn't we? Occupy Bristol a few years ago. Whatever happened to them?
Well, I think Occupy Bristol made a very good point. They're much more a generalist protest against the whole capitalist system. That's a very difficult thing to get a handle on for a lot of people. This is a much more symptomatic problem. Housing is obvious. As has just been said, everybody should have a roof over their head, even if it's just a very basic structure. It's done in places like Cuba, which are desperately poor. Why not here?
Okay, Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action. Good luck tomorrow. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
Now, we've heard over the last few weeks from a chap called Daniela Ganser quite often. He's the author, Swiss author, of a book called NATO's Secret Armies. And he's been speaking about all sorts of NATO-funded and NATO-organised terrorism in Europe, with civilians being killed often by fascist groups. Martin, just remind us, what is this Operation Gladio that he's written about, this NATO's Secret Army?
Well, he's an academic, Daniela Ganser, in Swiss universities. Basically, it was set up, it was justified to the powers that be, as if the Soviets invaded, there'd need to be some kind of secret army ready to fight the Soviet invasion. And then various groups were set up, funded, armed, trained, secretly, and then these groups started to carry out terrorist actions in Western Europe. There had been no Soviet invasion. They were just trying to steer politics in a direction that was suitable for, you know, the City of London, Wall Street, etc. And you know, one of the big bomb attacks they carried out was the Bologna bombing in Italy, which killed over 80 people. And it's been there have been three parliamentary inquiries in Switzerland, Belgium, and in Italy, which have looked into this. Anybody can check this if they just carry out some basic research. NATO has a track record of carrying out provocational terrorism. That's the main
point. One of the things Gantz has found out, I mean, it's good you mentioned Italy there, because that's what he's about to talk about. The P2 secret government, the parallel government being run in Italy, was behind a lot of these bomb attacks. Weird to think that you might get MPs, newspaper editors, actually going, meeting up at a country house and running the country from behind the scenes.
Well, all of this has been covered by Fernando Imposimato in his book, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, and he's the head of the Italian Supreme Court. People in the know NATO's a terrorist organisation.
So let's have a listen now to an interview done by Julian Charles from the website The Mind Renewed around about Christmas time of Daniele Ganzo, and here he is talking about Italy and the P2 lodge that was running the country from a country house.
The funny thing with the Propaganda 2 was that this was a network of people who belonged to the Italian parliament, to the Italian press, to the banks, to the industry, and they gathered together, but behind the official curtain. It was like a parallel government, and Lizio Gelli was the head of this secret network, and they controlled Italian politics in the sense that they wanted to make sure that the communists don't come to power. So they would pressure somebody who's in the press and say, you're not going to be promoted or you're going to be fired if you report this or that about secret networks. When somebody uncovered somebody, they linked up also with criminals or the mafia to solve things. And if you look at the Propaganda 2, you have to say, even Berlusconi was part of it, of Propaganda 2. Then you go like, madness, what's all that? I mean, this is not how political science textbooks explain democracy, because there they say, there's the people are in power. They vote, and then you have some parliamentarians who represent the people, and these, they pay good attention to what the executive does, and the executive does a few things, but only according to the laws that the parliamentarians wrote. And if anything goes wrong, we still have the press, and the press would certainly inform the people that something went wrong. And I say, oh yes, dream on. That's just the textbook. If you look at history, like real history, you very often have abuse of power by just a very small minority who keep everybody else in the illusion that they have a free press and that they have a total control of the power structure, whereas in fact it still is an oligarchy. Oligoi is the Greek word for just a few. And I think that's still true today. We have just a few who control the international power game. And the many, I mean, you and I and the listeners, we belong to the many. We can try to look behind, the curtain every now and again. But still, I think the few call the shots.
The few call the shots. Anyway, we're going to be doing definitely a different type of election coverage here that you'll get anywhere else, pretty much. Anyway, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock now, followed by Mohammed and his Arabian Nights, our sister show Dialects on Mondays at 11 a.m. This week, John McAllister, who's just won a David and Goliath courtroom battle here in Bristol with the mighty merchant venturer Edward Ware. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Bradley Stoke, UKIP councillor Ben Walker. Also thanks to Monsignor Bruce Kent and to Sukant Chandan from Malcolm X Film Festival, taking place on Sunday, and also, of course, Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action and Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. You can follow my Twitter feed in between shows at Tony Gosling, and I am Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down. And I'll leave you this week with some music from Ireland, No to Water Privatisation from the Rolling Tax Review.
No, I'm right. Irish water, Irish nation, no privatisation. No privatisation. Irish water, Irish nation, no privatisation.
And a kenny, not a penny, we won't pay at all, cause corruption of your policies is worse than being a fall. Jenny and Kenny, watch the paper trail.
Irish water's not for sale. No privatisation. Irish water, Irish nation, no privatisation.
Obvious, we've seen it all before. The traitor called us tourists while you battered down the door. But from Rossport to Jobstown, the 20-meter band, police brutality is black and tan.
No privatization. Irish water, Irish nation. No privatization. Irish stop.
Fighting a fight they're gonna lose, charging us for water that we can hardly use. The chloride, the fluoride, the cryptosporidium,
flush them out, cause it's time to get rid of them. No privatization. Irish water, Irish nation, no privatization. Stop.
I know there's 50,000 people and they're out in the street, all marching to the same beat. 100,000 people and they're on the street, all marching to the same beat. We've got 150,000 people out on the street, all marching to the same beat. We've got 500,000 people out on the street, all marching to the same beat.
There's no backing down, no concessions will do. The people have spoken, you know what to do. The time has come to stand and fight and not put up with the same old shite. We will strike, we will fight. Water is a human right.
We will strike, we will fight. Water is a human right. No privatization. Irish water, Irish nation. No privatization. Stop. No privatization. Irish water, Irish nation. No privatization. Stop. No privatization. No way. No way, no way, no way, no privatization. No way, no way, no way, no privatization. Irish water, Irish nation.